Very appreciative. So thanks, Karen and gang, and thanks, everybody, for coming. We noted yesterday when we adjourned, we're going to tee off the day with Jim's presentation on National Standard 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be speaking today on the guidelines for National Standard 2 and next steps. In the way of some introductory remarks, this PowerPoint that I'm presenting was prepared by NOAA headquarters, and it's to be presented to each council by a representative from a local science center. So being from the Northeast and as the head of the SAWSARC program here, I was designated as that person to present this to you. So it's a little bit awkward to present someone else's PowerPoint, and I'll be filling in and adding my own interpretation at times as to what's important. But just wanted you to understand where the PowerPoint came from. Now, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, as you know, has 10 national standards. And National Standard 2 is that fishery conservation and management measures shall be based on the best available scientific information available. So National Standard 2 deals with scientific integrity. National Standard 2 was revised, the guidelines were revised and amended, and were published in July 2013. And the purpose of amending them was to strengthen the quality and integrity of scientific information used to support fishery conservation and management. And for those of you who want to read the guidelines, there's a link there at the very bottom of the slide, and you can get to the Federal Register to the document itself. It's about 30 pages. There are benefits from National Standard 2 and its guidelines, and they are listed here. The revised guidelines make only modest adjustments to current operating procedures. So, in other words, there are no big changes that are being recommended. The guidance will align MSRA science with President Obama's and NOAA's scientific integrity policy. So better alignment nationally. Formalizing these guidelines will strengthen the reliability and credibility of scientific information used by NOAA. And this will improve public trust and benefit stakeholders. Now we get into the meat of the talk. The National Standard 2 provides guidance on the following. First of all, what constitutes best scientific information available, BSIA? Number two, the scientific peer review standards. And, for example, we all know that we have the SAWSARC process here that's used widely. So what are the standards that are used in a scientific peer review? Number three, the role of the scientific and statistical committees in the review of scientific information. And finally, the purpose and content and availability of SAFE reports. And SAFE stands for Stock Assessment and Fishery Evaluation. So we'll start off by talking about the best scientific information available and just what that means. The guidelines, there's guidance in there on what constitutes best scientific information available for improving fishery conservation and management. And the guidelines adopted all of the recommendations that are in a 2004 National Research Council report. And there are eight criteria to consider, or eight building blocks, essentially, that go into evaluating best scientific information available. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time on each of these building blocks. And they are, first of all, relevance, inclusiveness, objectivity, transparency, timeliness, verification, validation, and peer review. So starting off with these, I'll just say a few words about each one. And I think that if it sparks your interest, then it could lead to some good discussion after I get through the slides. So for relevance, that has to do with the pertinence to the current question. So in other words, when you're evaluating the scientific information, you have to ask, is this pertinent to the current question? And also, there's the option, for instance, if there are other species that have been looked at, perhaps in a different coastline or a different part of the world, and there are certain results that have been developed that apply to other species, those results could also be considered in light of the current question. So the relevance can apply not only locally, but considering what's been done elsewhere. Inclusiveness has to do with when you're evaluating the science, there could be a range of disciplines that need to be considered. For instance, there's biology, oceanography, and other things that all might have to come into the information that's being considered. In addition, diverse opinions are important to consider, as well as local knowledge and traditional knowledge that comes in from fishermen and others who are in the region who have this knowledge that can contribute to the evaluation. Objectivity has to do with the accuracy and precision of the information that you're dealing with. And also, under objectivity, the guidelines encourage that the process be kept free from undue non-scientific influence. So it's saying that this is basically a scientific process, and it should remain so. For transparency, that has to do with open access to the review process and to the evaluation of the scientific information, and to allow for public comment at appropriate times during the when the assessment is being developed and peer-reviewed. And it doesn't say that there needs to be public comment at every single stage along the way, but at appropriate times. Timeliness means that when the science is being evaluated, ideally it should be prepared and provided to the managers in a timely way so that it doesn't hold up management decisions. But it says that there are some cases where the management decision may be so critical that even if the science isn't fully evaluated and fleshed out, if a decision needs to be made, that there are cases where the decision should be made and to go forward and not let a scientific process that isn't completed yet hold up a very critical management decision. So there, as you can see, there's some flexibility and reasonableness written into these guidelines. Under timeliness, it says, ideally, however, the scientific review should occur and be completed first before the information is used by managers. Then for verification and validation, that has to do with the methods that are being used. Are they repeatable? Are the computer programs that are being used correct? And so forth. That's what that has to do with. And finally, the peer review. That is a process to ensure the quality of the scientific products. And it points out in the guidelines that peer review can take many different forms. There isn't just one way to do a peer review, and that the level of peer review should be matched with the the scientific information that's being evaluated. In some cases, it might be enough to have a review by reviewers who are reading a report and reporting by email back to the people that wanted them to do the review. In other cases, it's necessary to have a face-to-face review. So anyway, there again is flexibility there. And the Office of Management and Budget put out a paper, an information quality bulletin in 2005. And this is a very important document that the guidelines adopt basically as their guide. So everything that's in the guidelines that I'm reporting to you on peer review refer back to this document that was put out by the Office of Management and Budget in 2005. So there's some consistency between the OMB document and the guidelines that I'm presenting today. Then the NS2 guidelines consider the definition of best scientific information to be a dynamic process involving continuous improvements. And what that's saying is that they really can't put a really tight definition on what best scientific information available is, because science is constantly changing and the results are constantly changing as new information comes in. So in order to evaluate what best scientific information is, one should be considering all of the criteria that I went to at some length to describe in that second bullet. Now we get into the peer review standards. The peer review process is meant to ensure proper scientific standards are met and followed. The peer review process is an organized method that uses peer scientists with appropriate and relevant expertise to evaluate scientific information. The guidelines provide peer review standards, including reviewer selection criteria. And two of the criteria that they list: the reviewers must abide by conflict of interest rules, and the reviewers must have independence. And the bullet that's written there is must not have contributed to the development of the scientific information under review. And that's a definition of independence of peer reviewers that's used universally by peer-reviewed journals, for instance. When a paper is prepared, it's sent in by the researcher to a journal, and the reviewers have had no part in producing the paper that's being reviewed. The second bullet is the intent of the MSRA to provide the secretary and the councils with the discretion to establish peer review processes is affirmed. Now, what I can translate this for you, and what it means is that each of the regions, the council and the regional office and the science center, is encouraged to establish a peer review process and describe it in the Federal Register. And that's one of the things that we'll be doing. At the moment, we have, for instance, the SAWS-ARC process, and it's used in our region. But now we have to write a description of it and publish that in the Federal Register. And every region in the United States will be going through this same exercise. And the MSRA peer review is now consistent with the Information Quality Act and the OMB Final Information Quality Bulletin for Peer Review from 2005. While we're on the peer review standards, I'd like to just mention a couple of things that I found important under peer review in the guidelines. One is that the terms of reference for the peer review must be clear and set in advance. And another one, which was quite interesting, was that the peer review may not request reviewers to provide advice on policy or regulatory issues. And then in parentheses it says, for example, the level of precaution. And I think what that's referring to is that is the, for instance, the SSC's job to look at all of the scientific uncertainty that's been described in the stock assessment, and it's the SSC's job to determine what the level of precaution should be to recommend to the managers in making their management decisions. So the stock assessment itself should lay out all the sources of uncertainty and describe them quantitatively, but not get into recommending what level of precaution the managers should use. Next, we have the role of the scientific and statistical committees, and we all refer to them as the SSC. The role of the SSC is to debate and evaluate the scientific information so that the council will not need to do that. And so I want to repeat that. The role of the SSC is to debate and evaluate the scientific information that's been provided to them so that the council will not need to do that. The guidelines affirm the function of the SSC and that they should provide recommendations, for example, ABCs, to their council. The SSC's assistance in the peer review of scientific information is reaffirmed. The third bullet is that participation of an SSC member in a peer review should not impair their advisory responsibilities to their council. And what that's getting at is that SSC members often participate in peer reviews, and as long as they satisfy the requirements of being a peer reviewer, they can participate as a peer reviewer. And then when they get put on their other hat as an SSC member, if they have not participated in the development of the stock assessment, they can then serve on the peer review. They can serve on the SSC in the role of describing to the SSC, for instance, what went on at the SARC. They have, if the SSC member attended the SAW-SARC or chaired the SAW-SARC, they have a lot of good information with which to bring the SSC up to speed. And this was something that the NRCC talked about when we were designing, talking about who should chair the SAW-SARCs. And what we've moved toward in the last few years is to have an SSC member chair the SAW-SARC and to have other members who are on the review panel who are chosen by an independent third party, the CIE. And we feel that that's worked out pretty well, to have that SSC member embedded in the peer review team. And then when they take that to the SSC, someone is on the SSC who has really intimate knowledge of the stock assessment. And then, if SSC members participate in a peer review, those members must meet peer reviewer selection criteria described in the guidelines. And another thing that I'd like to mention that's listed in there is that the SSC should not repeat previously conducted and detailed technical reviews. And this is something which I believe is in the SOPs of both of our councils. The last topic has to do with SAFE reports. And the guidelines emphasize the importance of SAFE report as the source of scientific information on managed fish stocks for the Secretary and the councils. And there's clarification in the guidelines about the purpose and content of the reports, and the reports must be made publicly available via a website by the council or NIMS. So this is another action item. We have to for our region, we have to develop a website that has a link to safe reports. And there was a lot of discussion in the guidelines as to whether the safe report is one report or a compendium of all of the information that's related to a stock assessment and fishery status. And the guidelines tell us that it's actually both. But for our region, it will be all of the documents, not a single report, but all of the documents that contain information about the stock. And the way that we'll be handling this as our action item is to develop a website which will be called the SAFE website, and then within that there will be links to all of the different sources of information. For instance, the SAWSARC has a web page, the councils have web pages which have links to their FMPs and so forth. So the contents, I'll just say a little bit more about what is considered to be in a safe report. There should be the data sources, essential fish habitat, the assessment documents, the reviewer reports, biological reference points, information about stock status, OFLs, ABCs, information gaps, and SSC reports. So safe reports are everything. That's what a safe report is. And there was a lot of discussion when the guidelines were being developed because different regions handle this differently. And in the end, they recognized these differences between the regions, and they're allowing flexibility in the format of what each region calls a safe report. And the updating, there's no hard and fast rule about how often a safe report needs to be updated. It just says that it should be updated as necessary. So for some next steps, I have just three more slides. For the peer review, that we have to establish a peer review process and publicly announce it in the Federal Register. So we already have information describing the SAWSARC process. That's the main process that we use in our region for our U.S. fisheries, not for the ones that are assessed under international agreements, but for our domestic fisheries, the SAWSARC process is the main one, and that's the one that we plan to describe most fully in the Federal Register. The other processes that are used for international agreements will be listed in a paragraph below that, but won't go into the same level of detail. And it's also recognized that for the international agreement processes, there are other constraints involved. For instance, cooperation, working with other nations, and so forth to get these reviews and assessments completed. So the guidance that I've gotten from headquarters here is to describe our domestic process as the main process, and then to simply list any international agreement processes below in less detail. Then a little bit about what triggers a external peer review. There are all kinds of different assessments that are done. There are updates and benchmarks. And there are probably a dozen different criteria that are used in our region for determining when a stock assessment needs to be done. We have about 50 stocks that are all on our list, and it isn't possible to do every one of them or necessary to do every one of them every year. But one of the main criteria is the time since the previous stock assessment. And then there are a lot of other criteria that are used. For example, the stock status, the availability of people to do the work, whether there's extreme pressure at the moment from the public or politicians to do a stock assessment and so forth. But the in more general terms, the guidance is that every region shall conduct a peer review on all influential scientific information that the agency intends to disseminate. And the final slide has to do with this duplication of technical peer review. And it really doesn't, the bullets here don't exactly go into that very much, but it brings out the message that's in the guidelines about avoiding duplication of previously conducted peer reviews. And that's repeated in several different places within the guidelines. The idea is that there should be some economy and efficiency in how the process works, and there shouldn't be a lot of redundancy. In our region, we have for instance, the SAW-SARC process is a very lengthy and detailed independent peer review, and that information goes to the SSC, and the SSC is comprised of many people who have the same qualifications as the peer reviewers that were used in the SAW-SARC peer review. So in our region, it's tempting for both groups to want to reanalyze the entire stock assessment, but the guidelines are encouraging us not to do that and to keep the system efficient and to basically peer review the information, get ABC recommendations, and forward the information and advice from the SSC to the council. And it's the SSC's job to inform the council about what they feel is most important that they should know about the stock assessment. So then there are some other details about the terms of reference should be determined in advance, and fairly obvious things. So I think I've covered most of what I wanted to say, and I'd be happy to have a discussion now. Or if you want to go on with groundfish, that's fine with me, too.
I suspect that's your preference, but I'm sure there are questions. Questions for Jim. David.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I appreciate the handicap under which you are working. Your presentation was prepared for you, and you did a great job with it. So thank you for that summary as to where we are right now with National Standard 2 guidelines. I note that you emphasize, as you had to, that the peer reviews that will be done with this new guidance has to be consistent with the Information Quality Act and the OMB Final Information Quality Bulletin relative to peer review. Okay, so that's in your slide. That now this peer review is going to be consistent with all of that. So with that said, to what extent will the council, with NOAA for that matter, but certainly with the council, to what extent will we be able to move forward with the next steps relative to peer review, that is to better describe the process that should be used? How will we be able to go in a direction that is different from what now is mandated through those two directives that I just noted? It doesn't sound like we really have flexibility and freedom to go in a direction we prefer. It seems that the direction is already laid out for us.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of direction laid out for you, and it's, as I pointed out in one of the early slides, there aren't a lot of big changes being recommended here. The part of your question that I have to turn back to you with a question about going in a different direction. It sounds like you have something in mind about a different way to go, And I just have to ask you what you have in mind, because otherwise I don't know how to answer this.
That's a clever response. Well, I'll give you an example. Just a few years ago, Michael Sissonwine, Dr. Sissonwine, and Brian Rothschild produced a report that was commissioned by NOAA Fisheries relative to this, I can't recall the exact title, but the scientific process and used by the centers throughout the region. And they did conclude that high-quality research was done. The centers provide sound scientific information, but they did, that is, Michael and Dr. Rothschild did find many problems, and they then suggested through recommendations that the process used to produce scientific advice to support management needs to be changed in meaningful ways. Now, I can't recall all the specific recommendations, but I know that report had a great deal of weight, and I'm thinking that as we move forward, consistent with the next steps that you've described for us, as we move forward, we might want to, and perhaps should, reflect on those recommendations from Dr. Sissonwine and Dr. Rothschild to improve the peer review process. And they did have some good recommendations regarding that peer review process. And now I'm a bit, again, I wonder to what extent now are we going to be constrained by this new guidance, so that we won't be able to go in the direction that has been suggested by Dr. Sissonwine and Rothschild. So that's one idea that I, one thought I have relative to how we might want to move forward.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. I don't think that we are locking ourselves in or constraining ourselves too tightly on this. For instance, over the last few years, the Science Center has been trying to develop an operational assessment process which would pass stock assessments through the review process more quickly and efficiently and at a lower level of peer review. That process and any recommendations that are in the report that you referenced, as long as they adhere to the good scientific principles that are outlined, that I talked about under the criteria for best scientific information available, I think that we're open to accepting and making modifications. So I don't view this as locking ourselves into doing exactly what we do now, as long as we adhere to the principles that I outlined.
Okay, thank you. And one other question. And this is the question that where we might need Tom Neese's views. The SAFE report is going to be, you've emphasized in the presentation the importance of the SAFE reports. Suggest to me that as we move forward, as this council moves forward, with all of our initiatives regarding changes in management, we're going to have to, and updates, we're going to have to produce SAFE reports. I don't think, this is kind of a dual question, to what extent are we going to have to, through this guidance, produce the SAFE reports that you have described? Are they going to be mandatory now, and will they impose some restrictions on this council that will actually involve a tremendous amount of staff time that we don't have? I don't think we develop SAFE reports the way now, that we develop SAFE reports now, the way we'll have to develop them with this new guidance. So those are the two questions. Are we going to have to develop new SAFE reports that are very comprehensive, that will require a great deal of staff time, more so than what we have available now?
The quick answer to that is no. I don't think that you have to develop SAFE reports that will require a lot of extensive additional work. What is required is that there be a website that has all of the information that I listed with links to it. And it would be, I think, it would, in my opinion, it would be very difficult and require a huge amount of time to produce one report that had all the things in it that I listed. And it may work in other regions, but it isn't what we've been doing here. And I think all of the information that is listed is out there, as long as we provide links to it on a single website that's indicated at the top that is a link to our SAFE report. Now, I've just had a little bit of discussion about this with headquarters, and I'd like to hear what Tom Neese, his opinion is, and see whether, or the regional office on this.
Yeah, I've got Mike, Bill, George, and Tom. George, you want to go first? Or Bill?
If you'd like. Actually, I was on the working group that developed the SAFE report guidelines. And I was also on the group that wrote the initial guidelines. The SAFE report requirement's not new. It's not new here. It's been around since, I think, maybe 1996, and the changes in these guidelines are pretty minor, actually, in SAFE report. It was mainly to bring them up to date. We included EFH, which I think wasn't explicitly included before, and kind of brought it into the more modern age by suggesting that the documents should be available to the public through electronic means, as Jim described. There's a lot of discussion through the development of this because all the centers were involved in this working group. And through the years, the practices have varied considerably as to what different council, regions, center groupings have determined was their SAFE report. In some cases, there is a document that says SAFE report, and it's got everything in it. In other cases, probably the majority of cases, it's really a compendium of different documents that constitute the best available science. And the original purpose of the SAFE report was it was derived because people were asking, so when a council member votes on something, how does he or she know what the best available science is? And the SAFE report was supposed to be a way that the public and council members and the agency, for that matter, could at some point in time look at everything that was relevant to the kind of decisions they were making for that fishery and say, at this point in time, this is best available science, this is what we need to be using. So there's a lot of latitude in there deliberately because it wasn't really supposed to radically affect the way things were being done if they were working. But it was to make it more accessible to the public and hopefully more useful to council members so they can go to one place and say, here's all the important documents we need to be aware of when we're making this decision. Many cases are going to be in your analytical documents anyway, or at least referenced. But it's just a way of pulling everything into one place.
Mike.
Yeah, I also appreciate the challenge, Jim, of giving somebody else's PowerPoint. Actually, when I was the agency's chief scientist, I used to consider the most exciting thing I ever did is give PowerPoint presentations I'd never seen before. So you at least looked at this one. Anyway, a good presentation, but I have a number of comments. One on the SAFE report, it actually goes back a lot further than George just mentioned. I'm sure George is correct that that's when guidelines started to be developed, but the idea probably goes back a decade before that. And it was very much to assemble all the information that supported decisions in one convenient place. And at that time, there were a number of regions that published a single document, and I guess there may still be a few that do that. In this region, I can remember a former center director, and it wasn't me, it was further back than that, essentially refused to do that and said, we have a status of stocks report and we've got this other report, and put them in a pile and said, this is it. I think that was fine then, and that a web-based system is fine now, but it doesn't serve anybody's purpose if all it is a web-based system that has a link to everything. having everything is no better than nothing. So I do think that there has to be some thought about having some sort of an umbrella that provides some sort of a general synthesis that can guide people through how to get to the various links, and that there's some degree of caution about not just overwhelming with too many links that go to too many different places, if it's to serve the original purpose. And I think it is a useful thing to pursue, but let's not just have basically everything that's on the NOAA websites labeled as a safe report. The other issue I wanted to comment on, though, is that the agency is about to go through a process of describing whatever the peer review process in this region is in the Federal Register. And Jim, you basically referred to it as the SAW-SOC process, and that sort of gets me in some ways to David Pierce's question or comment. And that is, we've had various discussions over the last couple years about different processes that involve operational tracks and so on and so forth, changes from the SAW-SOC process. And I'm a little bit concerned about, because of these new guidelines, going through a process that sort of locks everything in a Federal Register notice without continuing or bringing to some sort of closure all of those discussions about what the process should look like in the future. Because I sort of feel like we're in limbo at this stage, and that should be pursued and crystallized and shared with everyone before it actually gets locked into a Federal Register notice, which just represents another bit of inertia that makes things hard to change. I would comment that this region is somewhat unique in terms of the SAW-SOC process and its peer review process from all the others, in that I would clearly label the system in this region as primarily developed and owned by the center. The CDAR, the STAR, the process in the North Pacific are much more connected with strong linkages and ownership to SSCs and councils. Now, there's a reason for the difference in this region. I, again, have a lot of history in why that happened. At the time it was developed, this region didn't have, or this council didn't have, a functional SSC. So somebody had to fill the gap or fill the void. But it does have a functional SSC now, and I do think there's a need to reconcile this to a greater extent with the linkage between the council process and the peer review process that's right now run by the center. Thank you.
Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also wanted to respond to Dr. Pierce's first question, which Dr. Sissonwine has focused on to some extent as well. And I think we do need to be careful here that the message that I think we should be conveying from the agency side, from the center side, is that we are certainly open to constructive change. How we manage that under the constraints of the requirement to publish the peer review process in the Federal Register, I think that's a good question, and it's something that we need to pay attention to, because I do think it's necessary to have a record of the process in the Federal Register, but it should not, I take to heart Mike's comments about the history of the process here, about how that it contrasts with process elsewhere, and about the importance of not taking the need for change off the table, bearing in mind that these guidelines are broad enough that change can be engineered within the guidelines themselves. So I think that is something that we really do need to pay attention to. One aspect of the process that I think is important for people to bear in mind is actually a change that was implemented as a result of the nationwide reviews of the science centers that Dr. Sissonwine and Rothschild did 3 or 4 years ago, and that is these program reviews. And I'm going to be speaking either later today or at the January Council meeting to provide you with feedback on the first of the program reviews that happened at the Northeast Center, which was on the fishery-dependent and fishery-independent data that supports stock assessment. More importantly, the review for 2014 will focus on the stock assessment process. And we're in the process now of developing draft terms of reference. The intent here is for that review to be broad so that it will focus both on methodology and process. And so, to my mind, looking to that review exercise as well as the kinds of conversations that we need to have with the council, the councils and other partners with regards to changes that we need to make in the overall process are really important. And as Jim noted and as Mike noted, we have been back to this council and to the Mid-Atlantic Council over the last couple of years with some ideas about change, and we have worked with the NRCC on some changes in process and some I think potentially very valuable improvements, but those are still in play. And part of the challenge for us is to figure out how to make change under the pressure of the number of stock assessments and other products that the council is asking us to deliver. That is an ongoing challenge, but nevertheless, I think we need to make sure we continue to focus on the importance of constructive change.
Tom. Yeah, your turn.
I've got a number of, comments, questions, and points I'd want to make, and Terry told me to have at it, so get comfortable. uncomfortable, yeah. The first one is, I think there's an important point that Mike brought up related to the National Standard 2 guidelines, and that is the emphasis on the guidelines that the ownership of the peer review process is not the Science Center or is not the agency, it's the joint ownership of the Secretary and the councils. And I think it says council, but in our case it's really councils because we work with the Mid-Atlantic on our peer review process. So I think the council needs to consider whether they want to take a more active role in developing the process and working on the process going forward. And as Mike pointed out, there may be a way to make closer links between the peer review process and the council and the SSC. That will probably take some time to figure out. Related to that is this requirement, and there's a number of administrative requirements in the FR, in the publication of the guidelines with respect to FR notices. I would caution that we should not get it in our head that because we publish a process in the FR, it's unchangeable. As anybody who follows fisheries regulations knows, you can change things overnight. It just takes 23 days to get something published in the FR. So, just because we write one process in the FR notice now doesn't mean that 6 months from now we may have come up with a new system that might work better, and so we shouldn't hesitate to pursue those new systems. With respect to Dave's question about the SAFE report, I would point out that maybe the center hasn't noticed, but, we have in a number of our fisheries been preparing SAFE reports for a number of years and publishing them on the council webpage. In the case of other fisheries like groundfish, where we do a management action just about every year, we compile almost all the information that's been pointed out in a SAFE report in the affected environment section of our management actions, which is why if you look for a groundfish SAFE report, you won't find one for a while. But I'd like to point out something that I think is worthy of emphasis, and that is that this issue of the National Standard 2 guidelines make it clear that the preparation of the SAFE report is the responsibility of the Secretary. And that the Secretary can use any combination of council staff and agency staff in order to complete the document. In our region, the lead on the SAFE reports has kind of been thrust on the councils. And at times, there's been some hesitancy to provide the information needed for the SAFE reports with the attitude that, oh, the council staff are professionals. They should be able to prepare those documents. We should not have to participate in that process. So I would hope that this emphasis that this is really a responsibility of the Secretary will kind of put those types of arguments to the side, and then if we need help collecting information for the preparation of the SAFE report, that the agency scientists and the regional office staff that can help us work on the safe reports will willingly contribute that information and will willingly help with the write-up of the documents for those safe reports. Because as the guidelines point out, ultimately the preparation of the safe report is the responsibility of the secretary. Moving on, I guess there's some issues that are highlighted with respect to the composition of peer reviews that I don't know if Jim can answer these questions or Bill can answer these questions. For example, there are some elements of our process which do not appear to be compliant with the requirements of the peer reviews. One of the elements of a peer review that's highlighted in the guidelines is that the person involved in the peer review should not have a hand in preparation of the assessment document or the work. You shouldn't be reviewing your own work. And as anyone who has ever attended one of the track peer reviews that are conducted every year for the track assessments, they know that that's exactly how we conduct the track peer reviews. Now, opinions differ. A lot of people think that process works very well. Some people think it doesn't work very well. But that seems kind of moot because that process, whether it works well or not, doesn't appear to be in compliance with the new requirements of the National Standard Guidelines on National Standard 2. And so I wonder what the agency plans to do or how they have planned to approach the Canadians to figure out how we're going to modify the track process to address this issue. Now, I recognize that the guidelines don't have the force or effect of law, but it seems like we should try and follow them. This other question that I have, and this is just about the bottom of my list here, is a question I think for Gene. And I'm a little curious how the guidelines work. The guidelines the guidelines talk about transparency and the verification of information and letting public information be available before it's used in the form of to take management actions. And so we have this whole process set up in the council system so that you review the information. But then once we submit a document, the document goes to the agency, and the agency makes decisions, and sometimes the agency, at least from what we know, what's published in the Federal Register notice or in our letter replies to us, the agency makes decisions that may not be supported by the scientific information in our documents. And my question is, how do the National Standard 2 guideline requirements for transparency and public notice on the basis of that information, how do they apply to the agency's decision-making process once the document is out of our hands? And is that information supposed to be published? So just to take this out of the realm of the hypothetical and take it down into a more practical example, the recent publication of the Federal Register notice for the closed area access includes some comments that state that certain areas are important for the protection of Georges Bank cod and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, which may be true. That's a scientific question, but there's considerable literature that points out that the closed areas may not be providing any real protection to those two stocks. So rather than have a conclusory statement in the FR notice, I mean, my question is, does the agency have a requirement to provide to the public, in the light of the MS2 requirement for transparency, some basis for that decision that explains what is the basis for reaching that conclusion so that the public knows what it is and the public can comment on it? So these are all, that's just one example, and we might be able to think of others in the recent past that would apply to that. So these are all sort of open-ended questions. I suspect that many of them, Jim, are not for you to answer, but I think they're kind of important questions that come up as a result of these new guidelines. I think that's all of them. Let me check my list.
Fantastic.
Yes, that's it.
Well, thanks, Tom.
I don't know if we're going to get any answers.
Jim.
I don't have full answers, but I would like to just comment on the question that Tom raised about the track, because I knew that one would come up, and I gave it some thought. The For one thing, the guidelines say that there isn't just one type of peer review, that there's flexibility, and that the type of peer review should match the purpose. There is flexibility in there. For the track, there are benchmark assessments which occur intermittently. When they do a benchmark, they don't occur every single year. The updates, which typically occur in June, that people around the table are more familiar with, have this integrated peer review process, and that's the one that Tom was certainly referring to. But it's my understanding that when they do a benchmark assessment, they have more separation of reviewers who are considered to be independent from the work that's being presented to them. So for the benchmarks, we might not strictly have a lack of compliance, and then for these annual updates that occur, it's a different type of process where the reviewers are integrated in with the people doing the stock assessment. But that's the rules there are that they're using the model that had been approved previously by a peer review, and they're not supposed to be making big changes from the accepted model. So those are my thoughts about the track. Also, it's the guidance that I said I got from headquarters on how to deal with this is to emphasize our domestic peer review process in the body of the Federal Register notice, and to acknowledge almost as a subscript these other processes that might occur that have international fisheries.
Tom.
So when you made that comment, I was just trying to do a word search through the guidelines, and I was trying to see where the guidelines specifically address that the best available science requirements differ under the international arena. And I couldn't really find that language in there anywhere. Could you point it out to me?
No, I can't point it out to you. Those are discussions I've had over the telephone.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I want to thank you for highlighting the responsibility for whose responsibility is to prepare the SAFE reports. And I want to put my voice behind your call to get more support in that. I went through the committees that I serve on, and the most recent SAFE report we have on our website is dated 2009 of those committees. And I think it's incumbent for the service or the commerce to, I mean, these are large documents that require an enormous amount of staff time. And I think it's important for us to make it clear to the Secretary that, you know, preparing these documents could easily monopolize the entire staff's resources. And so I just wanted to put my voice behind yours and asking for more support from the service and from Commerce in getting these essential documents out. These are key elements to this process, and we're, you know, clearly, you know, as other issues come up, we haven't been able to maintain the attention to them, and I think that's no fault of ours.
Mark.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jim, could you go to slide number 3? I'm doing that. I mean, I think it's fair to say that much of our science is in dispute in the eyes of industry, or is viewed as not credible. And I'm looking through, haven't read through all the guidance, but I'm looking at this PowerPoint, and I'm not seeing anything explicitly in here that deals with engendering more credibility with industry. And I wanted to point out something on slide 3, but I can't do that. That one. Okay, so at the top, to the revised guidelines, make only minor modest adjustments to current operating practices. And then in bullet 4, we get to this will improve public trust and benefit of stakeholders. I'm not seeing anywhere in here an explicit connection between those two statements that leads to the fourth bullet. So I think we have a credibility and a problem with our science, but I don't see anything in here that's explicitly designed to address that. An adjustment designed to address that. Could you comment on that?
Well, other than to repeat that I didn't prepare the presentation, I think that they're actually, having read through the Federal Register guidelines, it's tedious, but it's very well written. And I think if any region follows all of the advice that's in here, it certainly will improve their peer review process and how they run their stock assessments and how they utilize data. It covers so many things, and they're all good practices. And I think that if improvements made in any one of those ways are going to result in better products, and it should, by producing products that are better, it should spin off to the public. They may trust them. I mean, that's something that involves other things as well. But I think the best we can do is to follow these guidelines in the science and produce better products. And that's reaching out to the public is very important, and that goes hand in hand with doing the best science that we can.
Gene?
Yeah, just to respond to Tom's question about the agency being transparent and open and implementing council recommendations, I fully agree. If we should be, if we're not doing that, or if we're being inconsistent with best science, then that's obviously a problem. And it's an area that if we're not, to the extent that we're not being open and transparent about what science we're relying on and either approving or disapproving a council recommendation, we need to correct that and improve it.
David.
Well, Gene, just to answer my question, I wanted to follow up to Tom's provocative question. So with what Gene just said, can we assume that if it already does not exist, and I assume that it does not exist, there will be a far better explanation as to the science that was used to justify the decision that the service has made relative to access to the closed areas? Can we expect that to be forthcoming, since this is an extremely important and controversial action taken by the service, as indicated during the open comment period that we had yesterday? It's just a question, is this going to be, will the regional office address this issue of transparency and how the science was used?
Who's up?
I think science is part of the reason for the decision. I don't think it's the only reason. So I'll give you part of the reason, and George can give you part of the reason. I mean, when this idea was proposed and by the council and by the industry, and I was certainly initially very supportive of the idea, members of the industry came speaking about George's Bank and said, you know, there's an awful lot of haddock out there. We would like to go catch it because we can make an awful lot of money. And so we went and spent a lot of time exploring how that could be done. And when we proposed a rule to do that, we thought we laid out conditions where it could be done responsibly, sustainably, and in order to do that, it would require 100% observer coverage. And we thought, because the industry had said there's so much haddock out there, that the cost of observers would be borne by the industry. And then when the rule is out there, no, we're not going to go out there. We're not going to do that because we're not going to pay the cost of observers. All this haddock that's out there that we were told, the pictures shown on my desk, all of this, no,
know, it's not going to, we're not going to, there's not enough haddock out there. We're not going to risk it. So, so I don't know where the haddock went or where the story went that was presented about the initial reason, but it was no one is going to go out there under those conditions. No one. So the economic benefit, this is not science, this is the economic opportunity, turned to zero. No one under those conditions is going to go out there. So the economic opportunity to go out and catch all of this haddock went to zero. So economic benefit went to zero. We couldn't pay for the observers because Dr. Karp raided the piggy bank to pay 100% of the observer cost, as you know, for the regular fishery. So there was no money left to pay for observer coverage. So there was no economic benefit. We needed observer coverage, so no economic benefit. So it was, there was an economic argument, not a scientific argument. Now, there's still bycatch issues for cod and yellowtail. What did we find out in the course of this deliberation? We found out yellowtail flounder stocks were worse, in worse condition than when the areas were closed in, what, 1994, whenever they were originally closed. So it seemed, while worth considering when we originally considered it, to be something that did not make sense to us. So we, while originally open to the idea with that information, didn't seem to make sense. We did turn our attention to Nantucket Lightship, opened those areas, and with picking up the cost of observers so people could go into that without paying the cost of observers. So we modified the proposal so people could have access to areas without paying the cost of observers. That was the changes we made to that. You want to add, but that was the economic argument. Had nothing to do, that part of it did not have to do with science.
I think that's an excellent answer. I don't have much to add. If there was any new science that I recall, it was, as John said, we had additional information about the status of the yellowtail flounder stock that was even more concerning than what we knew when we were initially considering the request. But, I mean, this was a request for an exemption. It wasn't a new action. We weren't creating a new area. The scientific basis for those areas were already considered when the council established them. We were looking at whether an exemption was justified or not and trying not to do anything that was going to have long-term really bad impacts on cod or on yellowtail or on something else. So it was largely a consideration of risk rather than any new science that came to light.
Terry.
Well, I'm kind of glad this subject came up because I've been struggling with reading over their rationale for it, and you know, I think John has a good point. You know, the industry can't afford the observers and everything, but there are ways to divert. If we seriously needed 100% observer coverage in those areas to see what was in there, I mean, why didn't we divert a little bit of our observed trips that were going to go there anyway to there and see what the heck was there? You know, because we haven't been in there in 20-something years, so we don't know what's there. And fish probably aren't there when we first start fishing there. But we have a scientific paper in our packet here that tells us if we build it, they'll come, and the fish will show up. But we need to go in there and get things,
get things going. So, I mean, if we divert a little bit of our money from our regular observer program to not put it on different boats, put it on the boats that are going to go out there anyway, send those boats out there, see what the heck is in there, and see if we'd have an issue if we went there. And the Nantucket thing, as far as I can see, that's going to be strictly a gillnet fishery. Because in order to catch flounders, monks, and skates, and dogs is what the rationale says, if we're a trawler, we need to tow a separated trawler now. Well, those separated trawls are designed to get rid of that stuff. So, I mean, it's not an opening for the groundfish fish or the trawl fishery. It's an opening for the gillnet fishery. So, I mean, there are things that I think we could do to make it so it's usable, and we get the information, and we stop the angst with people saying, oh, my God, we go out there, we're going to just murder the yellowtails and codfish. I don't think we will. And I don't think we'll catch a lot of fish there at first. But once we get in there, we'll start turning things over, and things will come to the front in those areas because they're big producing areas. The reason why we closed them was because for mortality closures. The southern New England area was closed for yellowtails. I mean, that isn't even listed in the... We don't even know if there's yellowtails there anymore, juvenile yellowtails. So, I mean, we need to get in there and take a look and see what's going on in there. And the only way to do it, the industry can't afford to do it, the only way to do it is to say, okay, Chris owns a boat, and he usually goes to George's, so next time he gets an observer, let's give him a little, let him swing in through there with an observer and see what's going on in that area. I mean, we're all sitting there thinking that the place is full of fish, and we go out there one set, we're gonna destroy the whole place. Not true. I don't think that's true. I think we need to get in there and have access to it and see what's there.
Can I respond, Terry?
Go ahead, John.
Terry, I couldn't agree more that it would be very valuable if we could get one or two or three trips in there to find out something. And I think it would be very valuable for the industry to find out something, too, because it is a matter of risk to find out whether trips there are justified in terms of the haddock. So I could not agree more. Whether it's an EFP, I'm not sure the right way to do it, but I concur totally. And Willie and I, Bill, George, have said, what is the right way to do that? So we want to find out the way to get even a few trips into that area to get some, not just scientific information, but economic information for the industry, because that would be very useful to us and to the industry to see. As I said to David, this was an economic equation, and economic information could be very useful. So I don't want to give up on this. I don't want to give up on this.
Terry?
I know you hear us sit here at this table and say that, you know, we can't afford to pay for observers. We've had 3 years of not making any money. 3 years. Most businesses couldn't stand up under that for 3 years. We're getting down to a desperate situation, so there's absolutely no wiggle room for money right now. That's why the industry can't afford to pay for them. And there's got to be a way that we can work with the service to get some access to those areas, to get the economic information that we need. I mean, I'll volunteer my boat. You come on. You'll work. You can go as an observer, John. Come with me in January on the northeast peak of Georgia's, and we'll see what it's like out there. But I mean, I definitely think that there's ways that we can do this without. You know, tomorrow morning's discussion is going to come right back to this, and we're going to think, a lot of us sitting at the table are thinking, what the hell are we doing it for? You're going to deny it. So, I mean, that's why we need to figure out a way to get the information so that we can have some faith in the process that says if this council approves it, NIMTA's going to approve it. So,
Mike.
Yeah, I don't want to prolong this discussion about this specific action, as important as it might be. I wanted to return to Tom's observation that there are sometimes documents from the agency, decision documents, that cite science, and his question was, you know, is that held to the same standard? And I do think that is Tom's question is an important message that does require further consideration. That same report that David Pearson quoted or mentioned that I was involved in, geez, it really 4 years ago? It didn't seem that long. Anyway, pointed out that while many of us have some apprehension or question marks about the review process for stock assessments, they are controversial. It is the one area that receives the most scrutiny and most attention of all the science involved in decision making. And in fact, that report pointed out that there's nothing that even comes close to paralleling that for habitat, for social and economic impact assessments, and for protected species. And I do think that some of those are not subject to Magnuson Act, of course, because they're, you know, non-Magnuson Act decisions, but they are all subject to the OMB standards on data quality, and I do think there's a need for some follow-up that actually addresses the issue of the peer review quality assurance processes in all areas, not just stock assessments. Thank you.
Laura, then Jeff.
Just two things. With respect to the affordability of observer coverage in Georges Bank and Haddock, and I'm having trouble drawing the correlation of the fact that we can't afford observer coverage in the industry, and that means there's no Haddock there. Now, that means that Haddock isn't a stock like scallops that sell at the dock for $10, $11, $12 a pound. Haddock last week, the year class is coming through, was 90 cents. So it's an economic reality of the value of that fish versus the cost of a completely convoluted observer program, number one. Number two, I look for a little consistency in commitment to observers because, as we heard yesterday, there's no commitment to observing any type of recreational fishery. So it is very important for the commercial, but not at all important in the recreational, especially when they haven't had any reductions in their catch. So looking for a little consistency. And then finally, as far as transparencies goes, we had a gentleman who runs our SSC submit a paper to all of us under an ENGO headline letterhead yesterday declaring the need to keep areas closed without any proof of the productivity of those closed areas, which many of us question based on where we are now after 20 years of closures. So it really, as you sit here, and I'm just a common lay person, I'm not a scientist, but it really strikes me as interesting that we would have the head of the SSC who is directly working with the agency under an ENGO submitting a 3-page paper yesterday on how important it is to keep areas closed. So those would be my comments on transparency, consistency, and hypocrisy. Thank you.
Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to the document also. I wasn't a council member when we wrote comments to it, and there are a couple areas that we thought were important, and I wanted to just talk with Jim for a minute, if I could, about the response. One of them was on precaution. We hope that the guidelines, and I'm not speaking for the Mid-Atlantic Council, I've got to go back and read what the council wrote back in the day when the comments were first coming in, so I'm just speaking kind of as a private citizen and council member. We thought that the guidelines should address precaution and provide some kind of guidance to the SSC about levels of precaution that were appropriate. And I heard you say that and the guidelines say that this was beyond the scope of the guidelines, but there was a need to calculate uncertainty as accurately as possible. And I think you commented that that was the intention of the agency, that you'll do this through the science side of the ledger and be clear about that so that there's not an opportunity at the management level to add additional buffers, which has been something that's really, I think, plagued the industry as we've gotten our feet under us on the ACLAM process. So could you just comment for a second about how you're going to calculate uncertainty as accurately as possible?
Well, I think there will always be debates at council meetings about whether there are extra layers of buffers put in, and that's not something that will go away, because that stems from different people's perception of whether the science is, whether there's scientific uncertainty or management uncertainty, and how those build into the number of buffers that go in. So that's not part of the stock assessment. The stock assessment, what the guidelines are recommending, is that the stock assessment clearly identify the sources of scientific uncertainty and try to quantify them. And that information should go forward in a clear way to the SSC. And then it's the SSC's job to interpret that for the council so that the council doesn't have to fall into the role of being scientists. The SSC, those are your advisors, and they should filter that so that it's clear to you what sort of management decisions to make. So that what I was referring to specifically is when the terms of reference are written, say, for the SAWS-ARC, there shouldn't be a term of reference in there that says that the product of this should be a recommendation about what the regulations should be. That's a no-no. So that's basically what I was trying to say.
I've got one other follow-up. One of the things I did think was positive in the final rule was the importance of local and traditional knowledge. I think your slide 5 talked about inclusiveness and that need to ensure that LTK is acknowledged and evaluated. I was really pleased to see that response, because this so-called anecdotal information that people bring to the council every day, people wonder if it has any real value. So I thought it was very, very positive to see that information addressed as valid scientific information that could help guide the science and then management decisions. So, and then the final comment was, I guess we're going to start talking about information limited instead of data poor stocks. So do we have to go back and change all our documents to say, anyway, that's kind of a, I don't even know why I brought that up, but I really wanted to talk about the local and traditional knowledge piece. Thanks.
Yeah, could I just to follow up to that? There's something in the guidelines for everyone, because at the same time that it said that traditional knowledge and local knowledge should be included, it also says that they should avoid making this a non-scientific process. So it's very clear that it's a scientific process, and so when those comments are made, there has to be someone to interpret them and decide, okay, now how does all this fit into the rules that scientists use to go forward?
Thank you.
Okay, Ellen, you got the last word.
Thank you. I'll be really brief. I listened to everything that everyone said, and thank you very much, Jim. That was excellent. The transparency to me is definitely a two-way street. I'm really glad that Tom brought this up. And my request would be that maybe the council could write a note to the service. Nothing against the people sitting at the table here. You are hearing what we're saying, but we're not sure that everyone else in positions of power do. And I think it would be really a good thing for us to request specifically that the service provide a transparent reasoning when they come back with their decisions as far as what scientific information they have used to make that decision. Do I need to make a motion?
Yeah, is there any objection from council? Seeing none, we'll get something drafted.
Great, and I did have one last question for Jim, and that is I was very interested that you mentioned both accuracy and precision in the same sentence, and over the past several years, the scientific information that we've gotten from the stock assessments has been very, very centered on precision, and accuracy is not mentioned. So, not being a stock assessment scientist, but having given birth to one, I know that this is extremely important, and it changes the entire outcome of a model. So, can you explain how we are going to get back to taking into account accuracy of the stock assessment models when they're being peer-reviewed? Thank you.
Well, that's an answer that would take a lot more time than I think we have today, but I don't think that your sentence, I don't entirely agree with your characterization about just looking at precision and ignoring accuracy. You're probably thinking about observer coverage, but the stock assessment includes a lot of other components that have statistical designs for sampling that are standard designs, and those are developed in order to derive estimates of parameters that have accuracy as well as certain levels of precision. So to characterize the whole process as only looking at precision is, I think that's too narrow. And we'd really have to go into this in a lot more detail for me to really answer it.
Okay, before we segue on to groundfish, we've got the public, Dave and Drew, and anyone else? Maggie and Dick.
Thank you. David Gaethel, Fish and Vessel, Ellen Diane, the other half of that birthing process. My question is on best available science and scientific uncertainty. As we all know, the word best implies uniqueness. There can only be one. Is that still in the guidelines? In other words, are we still going to get a single model? Because there seems to be a emerging view of studying scientific uncertainty that comparing a number of models and the model runs will give you a better idea of where your scientific uncertainty is and what's causing it. I mean, it just came from an uncertainty workshop, and this was the conclusion of that. So are we still locked into one model going to the SSC, or will the SSC get perhaps a variety of models and model runs?
In general, looking at multiple models is an accepted way of doing business around the country and around the world. The way the SARC process has worked historically is they've been in the working group. They evaluate as many models as they want, and then they bring forward a best model that goes to the peer review panel for them to look at. And they can bring forward some other models as sensitivity runs to put the main model in perspective. But in general, the process works best if the peer reviewers are presented with, there's already been a decision made as to what the working group feels is the best model. And what we found is that when the working group comes forward to the peer review panel with multiple models, the peer review panel basically punts. In the amount of time that they're given, they say that they're unable to make a decision on which is the best model or set of models or results, and that they wish that the working group, which had all this time to really think about this in all its detail, had come to them with their own recommendation so that they could consider it. So for our own local process, it's evolved into this the working group coming forward with a best model. But we don't require that. It's a recommended practice for our working groups to develop a single model. But we say that if they can't do that, they can come forward with a couple of or two or three models and come forward to the peer review panel. And we I discourage that for the reasons that I explained. When it gets to the peer review panel, it just seems to get wrapped around the axle. And the goal of all this is to bring forward some clear stock status determinations that will go forward to the regional office and information that the SFC can use for setting an ABC. So the clearer we can make the science result that we're describing to the next levels, the better it seems to work in terms of efficiency for the way the process works. But I recognize your point about multiple models, and that's certainly, you know, a valid way of looking at things, and I recognize that.
Okay, I mean, I think with the process you described, I think everybody pretty well understands, but I think that it's the step from the SAWS-SARC process to the SSC, where the SSC may need more information to evaluate the model that's been brought forward as the best model. And is there anything in these guidelines that prevents them from requesting that information so that they can do, perhaps members of the SSC do their own sensitivity runs or things of that nature?
Well, that's where it gets into the suggestion not to re-review the work that's been already reviewed in detail. So in our region, as I said, the SSC has a lot of people with the same qualifications as the SARC peer review panel. And one of the radical things that I would consider moving towards 5 to 10 years down the road is to not have the two groups and to somehow combine the peer review into either an SSC or a SARC, but I think there's a lot of redundancy between the two. And if it was one group doing the entire work, then you wouldn't run into that problem that you've just highlighted. So other regions, I think, may not have as much of a multi-layers as we do here in the Northeast.
Right. That actually makes sense, because that seems to be the problem exactly that you just described that we have right now, is that the SSC is trying to evaluate models as they come forward and trying to figure out what the scientific uncertainty is so they can make a recommendation to the council on how to respond, you know, with ABCs, ACLs, the whole alphabet soup. So as long as there's nothing that prevents it, I don't see why we can't continue doing things the way we're doing it with the goal of streamlining it in the future to make it better. Thank you.
To this point, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, notwithstanding Jim's comments about the challenges associated with bringing multiple models forward, this is an issue that's being discussed at the Science Board level within the agency, because in other regions as well, there are challenges with regards to how you deal with multiple plausible models in a stock assessment context. So I think this question is still on the table, and I do think that at some point in the not too distant future, we will be looking at ways of adjudicating among multiple models or averaging across model results or some mechanism for recognizing the information that comes from multiple models in a stock assessment context.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
To this point, Mike?
Yeah, very briefly, I'm glad to hear Bill's comments about the Science Board looking at this. Bill's probably aware that the recent National Research Council report on rebuilding specifically addressed the issue of the problem of multiple models that are almost equally plausible and made specific recommendations about how to address that. One of them including management strategy evaluation, which I commented on yesterday, ought to be a high priority topic for the next meeting of SSCs at the national level. Thank you.
Drew.
Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. So sitting in the audience, I heard the agency acknowledge that the current track process does not conform with this guidance. And then the back and forth between Tom and the agency confirmed that despite it being an international agreement, it still has to apply by this guidance. What I haven't heard is what the agency's plan is to make the track process now conform with this guidance. So what is the agency's plan to bring track into conformance with this?
Well, from the discussions that I've had with the track chairman, the benchmark process is in compliance with the process, and the annual reviews that take place in June with the integrated peer review are the ones where you don't have as much separation. But as I said, in the guidelines, there's flexibility for gearing the type of peer review that you do to what it is you're reviewing. And I don't want to get into a lengthy debate about the track process, but those are basically my response, is it gets into a discussion of the flexibility and gearing the process to what it is you're reviewing. And I think there would probably be some consideration as well in the peer review processes that are international, where you're having to cooperate with people from other countries and develop a process that they can work with as well. So there's a history there to that development. So if you were to change any of these, I don't think it could be done carte blanche by a few people. It would take some time and a lot of work. But I don't have a whole lot more to weigh in on that with today.
Well, that's not very comforting, because the annual process, while not always a benchmark, there are significant decisions made at every single one of those meetings. New models are brought in. I mean, I believe a whole new split series model or a modified one was brought in an annual adjustment. Is that correct, Tom?
I don't think it's exactly correct, but there have been a number of changes made over the years where the assessments being used at the track differ substantially from what was approved at the benchmark.
So we've had significant changes made. We have basically zero separation from the people doing the work to those who are on the track, and these have significant outcomes for domestic and fisheries. And as we've seen repeatedly, when there were other parts of the act that people wanted some relief from, we were told by the agency, no, this isn't an official international agreement. It's only a memorandum of understanding between the two countries. Magnuson applies, and we had to go and get special legislation to give us some flexibility on the management side of things. So it's very curious to hear on the scientific side saying, since it's international-ish, we have flexibility here, and we'll do what we will when we can. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. If Magnuson applies, Magnuson applies. And you can't just say, because we're working with some Canadians, that we need relief from it. So far, these answers aren't acceptable, and, it shows the agency having a disregard for the law.
Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that I don't think that Tom Neese's question about the agency not providing the scientific information that they've used in decision-making was fully answered. And so I'm hoping that, again, I asked the council to weigh in again on this Framework 48 decision-making, and I hope you will do that. In the proposed rule, the agency provided absolutely no scientific justification for 100% observer coverage. The council questioned that in two letters in March and July, and that question has not been answered. There was no evaluation of anything between the current level of coverage and 100%. Only 100% was considered to be required, even though, again, no scientific information to support that recommendation. And as Terry Alexander pointed out, the agency could have said, okay, when you are a randomly assigned an observer, you can go into that area. That's exactly what we do with the herring fleet. Exactly what happens. When they get assigned an observer, they can go into closed area one. But that kind of consideration was not provided to the groundfish fleet in this action. So, again, I think it's really important that the council weighs in again on this decision and requires the agency to provide the information that they use to make these decisions. Thank you.
Dick.
My name is Dick Allen, and I'm speaking as a longtime participant in the management process. And on the topic of confidence and transparency, wanted to offer a couple of observations and a possible suggestion. When I've been involved in some of the stock assessments, it seems to me that in some cases there's basically one person that does most of the work, particularly in running the models and things like that. And it's possible that they can make a very important decision that's below the level that the peer reviewers can really get into. And it can have a significant impact on the results. And I know just in reading the general literature about peer review and kind of things that happen that later are found out not to be what they were represented as, that, you know, it's a fairly widespread problem. And in science, it's generally addressed by replication. People go out and try to reproduce the results that somebody else has had, even though the peer reviewers have looked at it and said, oh, all looks good. And I wonder whether it's possible that at some point in the stock assessment process, maybe, you know, after all the data has been gathered and things, and it's just a question of running a model, whether somebody else can run the model as well as the primary person who generally is expected to do that. And then if there's some discrepancy between the model results, somebody can look into it and see why that happened. And I know one case in which, you know, that was a pretty important thing, and like I say, it was just below the level at which the peer reviewers could really know what had happened. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. You want to follow up, Jim? You get last word.
Okay, just in response to those comments, I think the Science Center has some safeguards built in to guard against that sort of thing happening. When I came to the center quite a while ago, most of the stock assessment scientists had written their own programs for doing different kinds of analyses. And since then, they've developed a unified system of a whole computer package that has all of the different programs. And they've all been checked and verified that they work and produce standardized results. If you put in the same input data, they will always give you the same output. And so the center has made great improvements in the way these analyses are being done so that these kinds of things shouldn't happen, where someone may have typed in a wrong number in their computer program individually, which wouldn't be recognized by a larger group.
Okay, thank you, everyone. This has been a good discussion that will surely be continued. We're going to take a 10-minute break and segue into groundfish.